From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a Milwaukee researcher examines the broad importance of early childhood education programs.
In early childhood, I think one of our hallmarks is that we do think about serving kids and their families, not just kids.
Later, a Carroll University student says it's vital to work on behalf of people who can't speak out for themselves, like undocumented immigrants.
I think in this sort of climate, it's important that you are actively showing that you're welcoming and that you support these different marginalized groups that are under attack right now.
And actor Andrew McCarthy talks about the winding path that led him first to travel writing and now to his young adult novel.
I just become revealed to myself when I travel. It helped me walk through a lot of fear that I possessed in my life.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. Good morning, this is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Here's something you might not know.
Wisconsin does not require kids to go to school until they're 5 years old. That means preschool isn't mandatory here, but plenty of families still choose to send their 3 and 4 year olds to early childhood programs to give them an early start on their education.
But not every family can afford an extra year of school. One program in Milwaukee is working to change that. EduCare provides early childhood educational programming for kids ages 6 weeks to 5 years, specifically targeting kids from low-income families. It's an offshoot of Head Start, one of the most prominent publicly funded early childhood programs in the country.
A team of national researchers recently published a study in the Journal of Child Development touting the effectiveness of EduCare schools, including the only program in Milwaukee operated out of the Next Door Foundation on the city's northwest side.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello sat down with one of the researchers, Dr. Nancy File, a professor of early childhood education at UWM. File shared some of the best practices she studied, in particular those that she sees as critical for setting up young kids for success as they go forward in school.
EduCare provides care and education before kids hit public school. EduCares have one thing in common, and that's that they all receive Head Start and early Head Start funding. But beyond that, what they have in common is it's like Head Start, early Head Start amped up. So there's additional funding at each site, but basically allows for the center to operate at a higher level than your typical Head Start or early Head Start that's funded only through federal funds. So the teachers are more highly educated. There are more teachers in a classroom. There's an emphasis on involving parents and families. And then each program also has a local evaluator who works with the program to feed data back in to the program for short-term looking at the kids, how they're doing, long-term looking at the program and what may need to change, what's going well, etc.
You had 5 cities that you were looking at EduCare programs?
Four.
How does Milwaukee's compare to those other 3?
Okay, so we had 4 cities involved in the study: Omaha, Tulsa, Chicago, and Milwaukee. And the reason those 4 cities were chosen was because they have the oldest and most established EduCare sites. So they've been doing it the longest. Differences, the state differences are less important in EduCare because EduCare will go above and beyond any licensing. So all EduCares have 3 teachers. They have 8 children in infant toddler and 17 children in preschool rooms. They need to meet the Head Start regulations, so they come together around that. And they need to meet the philosophy of EduCare. The biggest differences among those sites are the demographics. In both Omaha and in Tulsa, there are a significant number of Spanish speakers. Amongst the families in Chicago and Milwaukee, it's almost all African American families. But they're all living at the poverty level because they all qualify for early Head Start funding.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, too, the difference in the training of the teachers. So when you're looking for a qualified teacher, what qualifications are you looking at here?
So EduCare asks that each classroom have a bachelor's level prepared teacher. EduCare also has 3 teachers, so that second teacher is ideally prepared with an associate's degree. Whereas in a Head Start center, that second teacher may have a high school diploma and perhaps some training. Whether we're looking at infant and toddler or preschool, it changes a little bit. Infant and toddler, we need teachers who are able to relate to very young children, provide that really responsive care, that when they're tired, they get to take a nap, and when they're hungry, they can eat. And when they're up and awake, they're provided with activities and materials that are going to meet their need to be curious and to find out more about the world. Educare also asks that all children during their infant toddler years have continuity of care. And that means that they are with the same teachers for as long as possible.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that was a continuity of care was a term I kept hearing when I was there. That's not something we always get in elementary school or middle school. So why is it so important when you are in that preschool age or that early education age?
The idea is that if you are going to have responsive care, you've got to really know the baby. And that baby also has to have a trusting relationship in the caregiver. In many centers, child care centers, kids are moved fairly frequently because when they turn a certain age, whether it's 12 months or 18 months, now all of a sudden you can have more children per caregiver. Or maybe it's, okay, now you walked, and so you're going to go with a different group than before you were mobile and walking. And so the norm is a great deal of change. So the idea is that rather than constantly getting used to new adults and having adults who are learning you in terms of your cues, what makes you tick, what you're interested in, what frustrates you, that the longer you preserve that relationship, the better off children will be. And the easier it is, not just for the caregiver to provide good care, but for the families to have that trusting relationship of, I know who this is, I completely trust them with my child.
You mentioned the parents, and that was another question I wanted to ask. The parental involvement, what's happening in EduCare to keep parents involved that's not happening elsewhere, other than, obviously, like you said, establishing those relationships with their teachers?
Yeah, so the relationships are important. I think also the emphasis on families. In early childhood, I think one of our hallmarks is that we do think about serving kids and their families, not just kids. In our preparation programs, we always have a class on working with families, which not all teacher education people get. So we have to think about what they have time for, what makes sense to them, what information they need, what information they have to give us, because they have a picture of their child that we never see at home. And the more that information can be shared, people can feel like they're on the same page, working together to help that child have the best life possible, we think that the greater the benefits overall. In addition, parents begin to learn more about their own child when they see them through the eyes of a teacher. Like, oh my gosh, she's really capable of that. I never knew because I never tried. Or look at what she's learned. You know, that the more contact, the more awareness you have of who your child is becoming, because you don't see them in the classroom as much.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a program for low-income families, especially when we talk about the achievement gap in Milwaukee and how stark that is here compared to some other cities. What do you think Milwaukee as a city could benefit from if more kids who are in those low-income situations had access to programs like EduCare? Do you think it would make a big difference?
I think that one of the things that we know is poverty is hard on children and it's hard on families. And the more that we can support families and children to navigate those difficulties, the better off everyone is. So many parents in EduCare work, and yet they still qualify for Head Start services, which means you are at the poverty level. So helping parents by saying, here is a place where you can trust while you're off trying to make as much money as you can or get job training or whatever, is an important resource for you. And all EduCares and also Head Starts have a mission of saying, what other resources do families need? How can we connect them to the things that will help them achieve their own goals for themselves and their families?
So it sounds like marketing those additional things is what might set apart an EduCare or a Head Start program mm-hmm. from, say, a home-based care program or
right.
something like that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the standards that all Head Starts are expected to meet is that families have what's called an individual family service plan, which is, here we've talked, we've found out things that are of concern to parents, whether it's, I need to get a GED, or I worry about food lasting through the month. We can hook people up with resources and help them, help the adults continue to meet their goals while we help the children learn and also help them as a unit.
When you said that, that just kind of struck me that when kids are young, we tend to think of serving them and their families, but that might not necessarily always be the mindset as they get older. Do you think it's a matter of shifting that mindset? Will that help keep these kids on the track that they're setting off with EduCare as they go into wherever they go to elementary school or middle school, high school? Or is it something else out of EduCare that's maybe a bigger takeaway as to why it's having such a big impact?
Well, I think, yeah, we could think about a couple potential things. What we can't do is unpack what parts of EduCare might be the most effective. We don't have that ability, but what we can speculate about is giving kids a rich environment where they're able to make choices and play and engage in beginning conversation rather than kind of being tucked away in an infant seat and put in front of a TV at a non-quality child care setting, that can be important, that helping parents to reach their goals but also get a sense of efficacy. Families may not have had good experiences in school themselves. They may not feel that they know how to advocate for their child, be effective in schools, and for schools to understand what it takes to help parents get involved in today's world.
Just as somebody who's been an early ed teacher and you studied it, not just EduCare, but I'm sure all different kinds of programs, it seems to me like because there is no mandate for care or school at that age, and because the funding is sort of an issue, you know, there's an EduCare program here, there's a Head Start program here, there's a home care center here, and it all just seems very jumbled to me. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you think can come out of a study of a program like this, something that's effective, that maybe all of those different places that kids mm-hmm. go or families go can begin to look at least, just to kind of make sure every kid in Milwaukee who is getting some sort of early childhood, teachers are at least trying to go toward this goal or set them up for this as they send them off to where they go next?
So you use the word jumble of programs, and actually we have a technical term for it, which we call patchwork. So early, it's very technical. Early childhood is a patchwork of programs. There are programs that are run by public schools. Here in Milwaukee, we call it K-4. The experiences that kids can have are so varied. It can be public school, it can be Head Start, it can be child care, and we know that child care varies in a huge range. And so we accept in our society that it's okay to have a range of quality for our children. We have home programs which can be both more intimate and nurturing or can be fairly unregulated and not so helpful to kids. We know as a field that infant toddler programs are among the most fraught in terms of quality. And we have more and more, as a society, we question about where babies should be, even if we've accepted by the time that kids are three, they could go to preschool, they could go to child care. So I think there's a lot to be done. The way that we look at it as early childhood education is every child who's four needs the same things and deserves the same things and has a right to a high-quality life. And no matter where they are, what kind of program, we would hope that child has those needs fulfilled. And we know that in our patchwork system, they don't. But there's a lot of work to do. And we also know that those programs that are high-quality do have payoffs for kids.
Nancy Feil is a professor at UWM's School of Education. She was part of a national team of researchers who looked into the early childhood programming offered through EduCare. Dr. Feil spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello.
UWM is one of several college campuses in the area that immigrant rights advocates have sought to designate as a sanctuary campus. Another effort is underway at a smaller college to the west. We'll speak with a student working on immigration issues at Carroll University when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. A directive this week from U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions called for more aggressive prosecution of people who've unlawfully crossed the border into the United States. Analysts say that would represent a significant shift in policy from the Obama administration, but would be consistent with President Donald Trump's statements made during the campaign last year.
A Carroll University senior hopes her work could make things better for undocumented immigrants to this country. Mackenzie Lowe organized a petition drive to designate the Waukesha School as a sanctuary campus. While she says that effort may never come to fruition, it is part of the work she hopes to accomplish on behalf of immigrants. We caught up with her at Carroll's Student Center building, and she talked about what inspired her work.
So I intern right now at Voces de la Frontera for part of my Spanish major, and they're working on making sanctuary campuses all across the state, and recently they actually just succeeded in making MPS a sanctuary district. So my supervisor, who I work with a lot, she thought it would be a good idea to start a petition at Carroll.
Well, and to your understanding, what's the objective in doing that? Why is it so important for, I mean, this is not a huge college campus. I don't know what the percentage of students who are from other countries is. What's the importance of doing it in a place like Carroll and in a place like Waukesha?
I think, one, to raise awareness of these issues, because a lot of people I spoke with didn't really understand what a sanctuary campus was or weren't super informed on the issue in general. So the first thing would be that. And then the second thing would just to be, I think in this sort of climate, it's important that you are actively showing that you're welcoming and that you support these different marginalized groups that are under attack right now.
Well, and so what kind of reaction have you gotten from your fellow students anyway?
It's actually been pretty overwhelmingly positive. Yeah, everyone has either like said, oh, I'm gonna sign it and share it, or just like said that they were really supportive of the issue. So yeah, that's been really cool.
And at the same time, have you heard anything from the school itself?
Yes, I have. I got a response that basically said that, you know, Carroll, we make sure to be inclusive and when like letting students into the university in admissions, but we're not looking to make the school sanctuary at this time. So it was basically like a polite no. So yeah.
What do you think, you know, what do you think is at stake? Why do you think standing up the way you are is important at this point in time?
There's a lot of huge changes that are going on right now. I just read a story last night, a really upsetting story, that a woman in Ohio, she's been in the United States for 15 years, is a law-abiding citizen. Well, not citizen, I'm sorry. She's undocumented. She has just become detained by ICE. And she's not charged with any serious crime. She has 3 or 4 children in the United States, fairly young children, and she's in the process of being deported. And I just can't even imagine how scary that is for her and her kids, because her only option is either leaving her kids in the States or bringing them back to Mexico. And I don't remember the name of the city, but there's been a lot of like serious crime issues there too. So it's awful. And I think someone like me who has a ton of privilege, you know, growing up in like a middle-class family, never having to like worry about these issues for myself, I think that it's super important that I work to help people that aren't as lucky as me.
Well, okay, so, I mean, you grew up in middle class Oshkosh, mm-hmm. Wisconsin,
yeah.
And without having to worry about these kinds of things for yourself. Mm-hmm. How did these kinds of issues even get on your radar screen, and what was it about your, you know, either your childhood or your time here at Carroll that's told you that this is something that I have to do?
I always kind of say that it started in my junior year of high school when I took my AP American Government and Politics class. That really like spurred my interest in politics. And the more informed I got, I guess the more interested in social activism I became. And when I got to campus, I got involved in organizations like Women's Equality and Empowerment, which I'm the president of, and Social Justice League, which I'm the vice president of. And so that kind of like, I met other people who were interested in these things too. And I just knew that like, I had to do something about it.
I imagine in your work with Voces de la Frontera, you've come into contact with people who might be undocumented.
Yeah, that is another big thing, like hearing these people's stories and just hearing stories about younger kids who are afraid to like put their names on these like projects that they worked on because they don't want attention being drawn to their family who's undocumented. That just like breaks my heart every time I hear or read about something like that. Because I can't even imagine that burden that they're carrying and that level of anxiety that no little kid should have to worry about.
What do you say to them when you're working with them, knowing what they're going through and what they could go through?
I try to listen, because there's not really a whole lot that I can do other than listen and then just say, like, you know, I'm going to work and, like, fight for you, you know, raise awareness of these issues. And I try to call my senators weekly and just, like, never stop talking about these issues.
Waukesha has a reputation for being a relatively conservative place, and I don't know about the politics of your fellow students. You said you've gotten pretty good reaction.
Yeah.
Would you imagine there are people around you though that come at this view, issue from a different viewpoint?
Yeah, I think there are. In general, I think people at this age are pretty welcoming and just understanding. But Waukesha's in one of the most conservative districts in the entire country, which is crazy. So that's important to keep in mind. But I also think that it's like been really good for me to surround myself with people that may have these really different views from me, because it's kind of forced me to listen and try to either like understand or like better my argument with them. So.
Well, and it's interesting because people in my generation, you know, I don't know that I'm an old fogey here, but the people in middle age and above, one of the issues that I think a lot of us are grappling with is our seeming inability to listen to each other. Do you think that people in your generation, are they more open to being able to have conversations with people that they respectfully disagree with?
That's a hard question. I think, depending on the issue, I have the opinion that, like, you are entitled to your own opinion and to your own viewpoint, but when that viewpoint is, like, rooted in racism or homophobia or sexism, that doesn't necessarily mean that I will view that viewpoint as legitimate. And then there's the whole issue with, like, alternative facts and just, like, the post-truth world we're living in, which is incredibly frustrating. But that doesn't mean that you don't listen, you know? It's so important to just try and understand, as like frustrating as it may be. And I struggle with this too. It's definitely something that I could improve on, but you're not gonna get anywhere if you don't like understand the other side.
Right, this is something that that we hear a lot, that there are people that, you know, used to feel comfortable talking to each other, you know, neighbors or coworkers or whatever, and now they're not even at a point where they can talk.
Yeah, it's really difficult, but you still need to have those uncomfortable conversations, because we're not going to improve as a society, and there will just be that, like, you know, like, I have the privilege of not having to talk about it. So, like, that's, like, all the more reason for me to, like, have those tough discussions with my grandparents or my parents that we may not necessarily disagree on, but just that, like, I know that those are really important issues that we need to be talking about.
There will likely be some people who hear this interview, and they might think, well, look, you know, nobody told the undocumented immigrants that they had to come here in the first place. What's your case for why we should be okay with people who came here through whatever sets of circumstances? Why should we let the status quo be the status quo?
When a family comes to the United States, whether it be legally or illegally, there's a huge reason for it. That's not some, like, thing you decide, like, oh, today I'm going to move my entire family, you know? Like, that's not some, like, decision that's not thought through very well. So there's that. And I think, in an economic sense, like, immigrants are good for the economy, and even undocumented ones, ignoring the whole, like, you know, we should probably be compassionate and, like, non-judgmental towards people. Like, undocumented immigrants contribute more, they pay more in taxes than they actually get out of the government, like through the sales tax. They can't cash in Social Security and other stuff like that. So they end up putting more into the economy than they receive out of it, which is important to keep in mind when you say, like, oh, they're stealing all of our jobs and, like, stuff like that. So
I know this is a lot for to ask of a senior in college, but what do you think the solution is? What would you like to see, you know, given that you don't support what the federal government is talking about doing now? What would you like to see down the road in terms of immigration policy that this country follows?
Well, I guess since it feels like we're going way far back right now, first, like, stop deporting people that are not serious criminals. And then in an ideal world, it's hard to see this as a possibility right now, but, like, some sort of path towards citizenship. Like, the Dreamers Act and DACA under President Obama, that was, like, great, and that was a victory for the immigrants' rights community, but that wasn't necessarily, like, the end goal, because, you know, all these undocumented people who I've met at FOCES, a bunch of them, they are able to work now legally, and that's great, and they can get a driver's license and all that sort of stuff, but there's no path to citizenship for them. So that, I think, is an issue that I would love to see fixed, but who knows when that will happen.
You know, you've collected I don't know how many signatures to try to convince the school to become a sanctuary campus. As you said, they've kind of given you a polite no. I imagine it's a little bit disappointing, frustrating.
Yeah, it is really frustrating. It doesn't mean that I'm just going to, like, give up, but It's something that I kind of was expecting, but, you know, you don't stop once you get a no from someone, so I don't know.
Well, and your college career is sort of rapidly coming to a close here. What's your plan to do with the Spanish background and this political science background and all this work you've already done?
So I've been applying to a bunch of organizing positions, and I've had a couple of interviews, so we'll see. I would, yeah, love to stay in the Milwaukee, even Madison area, and work. But, yeah, things are still kind of open right now.
It is an interesting time to be graduated from college, though. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. It's a lot better than graduating in, like, 2007, you know, but it's, yeah, we'll see.
Well, Mackenzie Lowe, thank you so much for your work and for sharing it with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Mackenzie Lowe is a native of Oshkosh and a senior at Carroll University in Waukesha. She was the organizer of an effort to designate Carroll as a sanctuary campus. You can read more about that effort at WUWM.com.
Andrew McCarthy is a name known to many people of a certain generation for his acting in movies of the 1980s and 90s. Why a new generation may soon know his name when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. For a while in the 80s and early 90s, Andrew McCarthy's face was instantly recognizable for his acting work in movies such as Pretty in Pink and St. Elmo's Fire. You can't mention his name without invoking the term Brat Pack. So there we go.
McCarthy was also in other films as well, like The Joy Luck Club. But more recently, he's been a director on such high-profile projects as Orange is the New Black. But he's also an award-winning travel writer as well. In fact, he contends that's the work that has changed his life. He's an editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler.
His life has more recently gone down another path as the author of a novel for young adults. Just Fly Away tells the story of 15-year-old Lucy Willows, who has just discovered a family secret and concludes that her life will seemingly never be the same. That book brought Andrew McCarthy to Milwaukee this week, and he visited with us in the Lake Effect studio. Welcome to the show. It's great to meet you.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So I try not to read too many interviews ahead of interviews that I'm doing, but I did run across a handful of pieces for this new book or on this new book. And you seem to be getting a lot of the who are you to channel a 15-year-old girl kind of question a fair bit. So I won't ask you that question exactly, but I do wonder how your protagonist, Lucy Willows, showed up in your mind.
Yeah. Lucy showed up by accident, really. I mean, I was writing another book. I thought I was writing another book for a number of years, like 5, 6, 7 years, really. I was writing a book about a man who had one night fling and a child came out of it. And he kept it a secret from his family. It was really a book about secrecy in marriage and what secrets do to a marriage over a long haul. And what bigger secret could one keep? So I started with that premise, and I was writing it, and I wrote it, like I said, for years and years, and I could never crack it. And I put it down, and I wrote another book, and I did other things. And anyway, my favorite character in it was always the 15-year-old daughter, who was only 15 years old for about 15 pages in the book, because the book, that giant great American novel, took place over like 25 years. And so anyway, my favorite character, whenever I sort of rewrote for the umpteenth time that section of the book, I loved Lucy. And I found it very easy to write her. So then one day I was sitting on a plane, literally waiting to take off. We were delayed. And I just pulled out my computer and I just started typing. My dad has this other kid living across town. What's going on? And suddenly I was just writing from her perspective and her point of view. And everything about the book then changed.
And what's interesting about how you just put it there is the thing that really is compelling from the get-go is how that knowledge changes everything for Lucy. There's, you know, the finding out of her father's affair and the existence of her half-brother sort of divides everything into what came before and what will come afterwards.
Yeah, I love that moment in people's lives, the before and then after, and then there are several in each life, I think, and that's one for her. You know, in the book, it's interesting. This book has nothing in common with the other book that I was writing at all, except for this inciting incident. None of the plot is the same. But what was interesting to me was that all the characters were the same. The world was the same. So wherever I went, wherever Lucy sort of led me, I knew exactly the world that she was living in. I knew the relationships and the dynamics with all the people involved. So that was, it was as if the big book died in the woods and it was a nurse tree and this little book sucked all the nutrients out of it. I mean, that's the perfect sort of description in my mind because this took everything that was good about that book, even though the plot is not at all the same.
What do you think was bad about that book?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know that it was particularly bad. It just didn't seem compelling in a certain way. And I think I had difficulty holding the momentum over 20-odd years. And, you know, I think one of the things that I was so close to that other character. I was writing from a close third person, but I was still very much like the father in many ways, that once I had the distance of Lucy, I was actually quite freed up. People don't seem to, people seem to think that's odd, but it's like acting with an accent in a certain way. Suddenly words are coming out that you don't normally say and you're walking funny and but you're free in a certain way. I had a friend of mine who's a novelist, travel writer as well, the wonderful Pico Iyer. He said, a line which I thought was great, that was, I finished my travel book, and he said, what are you working on now? And I said, I'm struggling with a novel. And he said, oh, good, now you can put in all the things that were too personal to put in your memoir, which I think is exactly the truth.
So when you're writing this, are you Lucy?
Totally. I mean, I'm writing from the 15-year-old in myself to the 15-year-old in myself. What was interesting to me was diving into the YA genre, which I knew nothing about young adult literature, which I think is a sort of weird delineation. I'm not quite sure what the point is, but except that it's why literature seems to have, and today's seems to be very direct emotionally and unapologetic and tackles issues just head on right there in your face, which I really thought was interesting with Lucy, and she seemed absolutely of that.
Well, I was also wondering, I mean, you have, I think, what, 3 kids of your own?
I do. Feels like 30. Yeah.
did you feel at any times parental towards Lucy when you were writing her?
I tried not to. I tried not to feel parental toward her because I tried to just follow her and keep up with her. I mean, it was the only time I've ever written anything where I didn't know how sentences were going to end when I started them, which was very exciting. The only thing I did right in the book was that I just had faith in process and just stepped out on each thing that she did. But no, I tried not to parent Lucy because she's unreliable as a narrator in many ways. So, but what is interesting is that it didn't have the adult, you know, wisdom, for lack of a better word. She just had the sheer reaction and her emotional, visceral reaction. And that's what the world we were immersed in, which is one of the things that makes it YA. And so, as opposed to, I could have written this from an adult book and had some wisdom about it, I suppose. But no, I tried to completely stay out of the way. And when she was unlikable and did unlikable things, that's people.
Well, right. She's unreliable in so much as any 15-year-old is unreliable. Not intentionally.
It's the truth. It's the truth to her. It's like, why isn't anybody else seeing this the way I'm seeing it? What's the matter with everybody? Why does nobody understand me or appreciate me? Why am I so alone in the world? Will everybody else get their act together, please? Which, you know, many of us still feel like, except we have that adult voice in our head, which kind of goes, no, that might not actually be reality, but we can still feel that way. Whereas if you're 15, you're just discovering all this stuff and you just follow that.
And at the same time, most of us don't have the luxury of there being necessarily this one moment where we see a parent differently. It for a lot of us, might be more like the dripping of a leaky faucet.
That's very true, I think. But I think that's when we realize that our parents have their own individual lives and haven't been looking at us all the time and have, in fact, been looking away and doing their own things. I think it's a really terrifying moment. I mean, all of us want to be away from these horrible people that are nagging us all the time, our parents. And yet, when we discover that they are, I think it's a terrifying moment and a moment of betrayal. And that leads to all that teen angst and anger we often, you know, because I think it's very real because you've been very safe in the world. Your parents have been there watching out for everything. And then you realize that's not the case. Huh. And I think that is infuriating.
And at the same time, thinking about it from the standpoint of a parent, in a way, you know, and I hesitate to say this because my kids maybe are not yet old enough to have completely figured that out about their dad. But it's a little bit of a relief.
Well, I think eventually it's a relief, and I think it's, you know, a discovery of mixed feelings. You know, before adolescence, I don't know how much we're aware of mixed feelings, you know? And I think eventually it's a relief, but it's a process to get there. I think that's largely what the book is about, Lucy's process, and how does one deal with this issue that nobody else seems to need to grapple with.
Coming to terms with the fact that
my dad has this kid that he lied to us about. And don't you think that's kind of important that we should have known about that? and why isn't my mom reacting like she should be? And why is my sister oblivious and not care? It's like, what's going on with everyone?
All of her frames of reference are changing.
Yeah. And it's just her world turns on its axis and, you know, sets her about looking for answers, which, you know, one of the things I enjoy about Lucy is that she's just impulsive and, you know, she goes on a journey in the book, but it has no intention of going on a journey. She just sort of goes out the door, and then she turns left, and then she turns right, and then suddenly that happens, and she's far from home, and oh, wow. You know, it's one of the things I love about – I'm a great believer in the value of escape. I mean, I'm a travel writer in my other life. I love the notion of escape, and I often feel like we're escaping to the very thing we need to find as opposed to running away from things. I often don't know what I'm looking for, and then I run smack into it, and I would have gone, oh, that's what it was I was looking for. And that's been my experience in life. I mean, travel has been sort of the university of my life. My growth has come from hitting the road alone and then being confronted with issues that were revelatory to me.
This is a perfect transition into perhaps
that's
a
the
little
business we're in,
this
isn't
is
it? The transition business.
Spectacular segue. there is a section where, and I don't know, this is obviously not a spoiler because you just mentioned it. Lucy goes on a road trip, sort of an inadvertent road trip to Maine to see her grandfather, and it would be great if you could share just a little bit of her getting going on this trip.
She gets on a train. She happens to find herself at a train station as without any intention of boarding one, and then she does. I almost skipped on board. I turned left and went into the forward car. There were plenty of seats, but I walked to the very front of the car and then all the way to the back. The train started to gather speed, and I was looking out the windows left and right, walking back up the aisle, swaying side to side with the motion. I felt giddy. I ended up on the left side in the window seat near the front for no reason. I'd taken the train into the city only a few times in my entire life, once when my dad's car was broken and we were going to the circus, and another time when my mom took my sister and me to see a matinee, and one other time when some friends and I went ice skating at Rockefeller Center. Otherwise, my dad drove us. Not that we went into the city all that much. Trains are very pleasant, except for the fact that very few things actually face the railroad track, so consequently, you're usually looking at the back of people's lives. The people throw a lot of junk out the back of their buildings. My view is scarred by their debris. The redeeming thing about all this, however, is that the scenery moves by so quickly on a train. The instant you see some rusted car, empty derelict swimming pool, things that were originally intended to bring joy, the view changes and you can forget all about the sorry sight and take in the next little disappointment that life out your window has to offer. It was good to be in motion. Lucy.
Well,
I like her.
I do too, and that realization of what you see from a train is something that I think all of us, anybody who's taken a train trip, there's this romantic notion of what it will be like, and then there's the reality.
Yeah, no, I've always thought that was, nobody ever talks about that. That, like, you're always looking at junk and out the back, and it's just not that attractive. Things are not geared toward, you know, it's not front of house.
And there's a reason that the people talk about the other side of the tracks.
Yeah, I suppose there is. You know, when I was young, I used to go to the railroad tracks in my youth and just sort of alone, and I used to just sort of hang around there and flatten pennies. And it has a place of strange melancholy, wistfulness about it, and danger, you know, the implicit danger of it, and something about it.
The last line there, it felt good to be in motion. Can you talk about the emotion that you get from being in motion? I mean, is it happiness? Is it something else?
I think it's inherently a sense of optimism in a certain way. And I just read this line somewhere. I can't tell you who said it, but there's a man with no past is happy. A man with nothing but a past is not. I'm misquoting, of course. But so when you're traveling and you're in motion, it's as if you have no past. You only have future, and you're just right here looking forward only. It's very American that way. Paul Theroux, the great travel writer, said, you know, travel is optimism in motion. And I just think that's true.
What is it about sharing those experiences or those discoveries with people that attracts you to travel writing?
Well, travel changed my life in a very real way, and it was Paul Theroux's books that did it. You know, I read one of the old Patagonian Express, I believe, train book, and he opened my eyes to a way of traveling that I had never conceived of before, and so I started traveling that way, alone and into the world and without plan and without a net, as it were. And I found it revelatory. You know, I just thought it changed the way I perceived myself in the world and the way I looked at the world. So to me, travel had value. It had real purpose. It wasn't, you know, something for the wealthy or the, you know, frivolous or people with idle time. It was a real thing of value to do. And a lot of the travel I was reading about didn't bring that to it. It was selling places. So I just started writing first-person experiential travel stuff that seemed to resonate with people. Because underneath every article that I write, whether I'm writing about Paris or wherever, is that this is important. It changed my life. It can change yours. This matters. And so I think people resonate with that.
Do you think people put too much pressure on having experiences without being necessarily just open to experiencing whatever comes their way?
Well, a lot of travel is not fun. Travel isn't necessarily supposed to be fun, in my mind. I'm not looking for, you know, trophies or various things. I mean, a lot of travel is boring, hard, lonely, all sorts of things. I just become revealed to myself when I travel. It helped me walk through a lot of fear that I possessed in my life. So I think often people expect the wrong thing of travel. It's not supposed to be this greatest hits of our life every moment of the day. That's not what the point. But that's vacation. I'm not much of a vacationer. I don't really believe in vacation. So I get, what do I do on the beach after the first 10 minutes? I don't know. So, but I like traveling, which is very different, which is also just putting yourself vulnerable out into the world and asking to be received by the world.
Is it at all odd for you to be doing this version of travel, the version that takes you to bookstores and radio stations and TV studios?
Well, yeah, because people say, oh, this must be great. You must love this. Traveling, I go, this is the anti-travel. This is everything that I don't like about it. It's just hotels to places, to venues, to hotels, to airports and things. So it's not really travel to me. It's just going from place to place, which I actually do enjoy. There's a thrill in arrival that is undeniable, like just arriving here an hour ago in Milwaukee. It's just like, whoa, I don't know this place. And there is a sense of thrill about it.
Do you think about the audience for this new book, what the 13 or 14 or 15-year-olds are going to be left with when they finish reading it?
Well, what I was surprised to find out was the majority of YA readers are actually adults. But hopefully, you know, when I wrote the book, what do I know about being a 15-year-old girl? And I wrote the book in kind of a bubble. Once I started it, I didn't show it to anyone. I normally inflict a lot of my writing on my wife, and I didn't even tell anyone I was making this transition because I already had this book. What was I doing? So I wrote it sort of in secrecy. And then when I finished it, I gave it to my neighbor who was 15, I asked her to read it, and she said, who wrote it? What is it? And I just read it and don't tell your parents. And anyway, she read it and said, this sounds like me and my friends, which was a huge relief, of course. But I suppose what you always want is just people to nod their head and go, yeah, that's me. I understand that. I have been doing a lot of interviews since I've started talking about the book. I've been shocked to find out that people, at least 24 people have come up to me and told me on a literal level about secret siblings and people that knocked on their door 30 years later and go, I'm your sister. People that showed up at funerals and, you know, stepfather who turned out to be the biological father. I was talking to a reporter the other day and he was very cold to me on the phone and very distant. And I was like, wow, this guy really hated the book. I don't know why he's bothering to talk to me. I can't wait to get off the phone with him. And then right at the end, he goes, yeah, a little, full disclosure. I am the product of a one-night fling, and never knew my father, and I have two siblings that I've never met that live a few towns over. And I'm like, dude, that's my book. You know, so he had this very strong reaction, which he wasn't allowing himself to go to in a certain way. But then we had a great discussion. But so there's a lot of it, you know, there's a lot of secrets out there, you know?
Do you have a sense for how long after the events of this book Lucy is recounting them?
Oh, interesting. It's not that long. A few months, 6 months. Just like the way when we think we know something when we're young, that was a long time ago. And it was like, you know, 8 weeks ago. You know, I'd say several months, you know, because she's beginning to process. But she's still not there.
Right.
You know?
I was trying to figure out if she knew that she was going to be okay.
I mean, Lucy's going to be a great adult. She just has to get there. That's how I always thought of her. When I did parent her, I always knew she's going to be a great adult, so I don't have to worry about her. As long as I don't get her hit by the train, she's going to be fine. You know what I mean? So I kept that in my mind all the time.
I think it's an underrated part of adolescence, not just the realization that your parents are flawed, but at some point figuring out that you're going to figure it out.
Well, I remember when I was young, staring in the mirror and because I looked so young and literally staring in the mirror going, please let me just know what it's going to be like, look like in 10 years, what I'm going to look for, just for a second, so that I know I'm going to get, it's going to be okay. Because there's a very real feeling that I was always afraid my life just is not going to begin here. And on one hand, your world is everything and you're the most important thing in it. And yet on the other hand, it's like, it's never going to happen. So it's a difficult moment.
And then you wake up and it is 20 years later.
And you're still asking the same things.
Listen, Andrew McCarthy, it really is a terrific book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks.
Andrew McCarthy's new book for young adults is called Just Fly Away. He's also editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler. He's directed TV shows such as Orange is the New Black and Grace and Frankie.
And, of course, he starred in some pretty iconic movies over the years, including Less Than Zero and Pretty in Pink, not to mention Mannequin and Weekend at Bernie's.
Andrew McCarthy writes and talks about that pivotal age just when you want to know how your life will turn out. Well, Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler thinks it's important to consider history through the eyes of someone who can appreciate the passage of time.
If the study of economics is called the dismal science, the study of history must run a close second. According to the American Council of Trustees, history is so dismal that only 18% of the colleges require a course in either history or government. For those of us graying at the temples, government and history courses were like going to the dentist. There was no escape. For me, it was civics in the 9th grade, U.S. history in the 11th, world history as a senior, and Western civilization as a college freshman. All required. How about you? Maybe it doesn't matter if today's history students, like the old Sam Cooke song, don't know much about history. Henry Ford would have agreed with Sam when he famously said, "History is more or less bunk." Others see it differently. Will and Ariel Durant, among the preeminent historians of the 20th century, said the study of history becomes, quote, "a celestial city, a country of the mind, wherein 1,000 saints, statesmen, inventors, scientists, poets and philosophers still live and speak, and most importantly, they still teach." Admiral Hyman Rickover, father of the nuclear submarine fleet, said it in less philosophic terms. "You have to learn from the mistakes of others. You won't live long enough to make them all yourself." I caught the history bug from Mr. Phillips in high school and Professor Alston at the University of Iowa, and I've been its student ever since. In my opinion, history gives perspective and helps make some sense out of the unpredictable and sometimes often insane events of today. I hope I can make it your opinion, too. So you're saying history repeats itself? No, not according to the Durants. History repeats itself only in outline and the large. So think of some of the hot-button issues of today. Let's see if history can give us guidance. If you didn't know history, you wouldn't know that many presidents had a rocky relationship with the press. Nixon and the press absolutely hated each other. Lincoln endured cartoons depicting him as an ape. Lyndon Johnson faced a credibility gap, with the press openly accusing him of lying over what he claimed was progress in the Vietnam War. If you didn't know history, you wouldn't know that tariffs, that is, the taxing of imports to make them more expensive, have always been controversial. In 1833, South Carolina threatened to secede from the Union, not over slavery, but over tariffs. Many economists agree that the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s deepened the Great Depression by practically destroying international trade and the American jobs that went with it. If you didn't know history, you wouldn't know that almost all presidents have had trouble with their subordinates. Eisenhower had to fire his chief assistant, Sherman Adams, for taking gifts in exchange for government favors. Earl Butz, President Ford's agricultural secretary, was forced to resign for telling a racial joke to, of all people, a group of reporters. During Warren Harding's administration, his Secretary of the Interior, Albert Fall, went to prison for taking bribes from oil companies. Now let's relate history to people. Not people in general, but to you and to me. My wife says 35 is the perfect age, old enough to know what you're doing and still young enough to do it. Nobody says that about age 13. Do you remember? I'll bet you do. Painfully, just like me. The awkwardness, the trauma, the discomfort of trying to figure out young adulthood. Every day seemed rudderless, a sail into uncharted waters. At age 35, you and I had personal history to draw upon. At age 13, none. It's no stretch, I think, to compare age 13 to a person with little or no historical background. The historically uninformed have not been there, done that. They have not seen this movie before. They are left to be historically, perpetually 13 in all of its awfulness. So what's the answer? Granted, history doesn't repeat itself, but try this. If your historical appetite has been whetted, buy a history textbook and read it. Then give it to your kids. If it's a good one, let me know. I need to read it too. And after that, maybe, just maybe, you and I will have a little more perspective as we read the news stories of tomorrow.
Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler is a retired newspaperman who now lives in Brookfield. And that's all for Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. So great to have you with us today. Thanks for tuning in. And do join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.